I'm Lachlan. I am a lecturer of politics at Monash University. I got my PhD in political science from Stanford in 2019, and my book, Settling for Less: Why States Colonize and Why They Stop, came out at Princeton University Press last year. And the book is a global and comparative history of essentially settler colonialism. So I look at settler colonialism in China, in Indonesia, and other non-Western countries, and think about how these projects, where states have settled the lands of peoples like the West Papuans or the Uyghurs in Xinjiang with members of dominant ethnic groups, and how these projects are similar and different to what we often think of as settler colonialism, which is what Britain did or France did. In the 1900s and 1800s, in much of the New World, European empires settled the lands of indigenous peoples. So the book is trying to bring all of these different colonization projects into one framework and think about how these logics are both similar and different in these different projects.
In your book, you talk a bit about how there's a triangle of interests that underpins the logic of colonization. So, could you talk to us about whose interests play a role in why states colonize in ways that we might not assume?
Yeah, so the main move I think I make in the book is to think about settler colonialism through a triangle. So previously, we often think about colonization projects like Britain in Australia, or when we do think of non-Western contexts, it might be China and Tibet. We often pay a lot of attention to what leaders are doing, what leaders are saying, what leaders' intentions are, what their ideologies are, whether they're governed by logics of white supremacy, for instance. And we think about how these logics affect how they interact with indigenous peoples who might be seen as kind of racially inferior. So in the book, what I'm trying to do is really insert a third actor that I think is really important here into the conversation, which is the interests and actions of settlers themselves. So settlers are kind of ordinary members of a dominant ethnic group, so maybe Han Chinese in China or white Britons in Britain in the 1800s. And these settlers are themselves deciding whether they're going to go emigrate to a frontier area or not. And they can either do so when the state is enticing them to do it, they can decide whether to take up the offer of free land or not. And even when the state is kind of trying to forbid them to go to a frontier area, like Britain tried to forbid Europeans from kind of colonizing in India, and tried to prevent Europeans from colonizing Victoria or Americans from colonizing across the Appalachians during the after the Seven Years' War with France. Settlers might just disobey these orders and start taking land on the frontier themselves, and these actions kind of bring the state into conflict with indigenous peoples in ways they might not have intended. So the book is really about trying to understand these different interests, this triangle of settlers against states, against indigenous peoples, and how this shapes the logic of settler colonialism, both in the 1800s and to the current day.
I think that from your answer just then, you've demonstrated that colonization is something that is employed by states all over the globe. And in your book, you talk about the fact that colonization is actually one of many tools that states employ. You talk about states using colonization as a way of either establishing the state, so state building, or ensuring the state's security. Could you talk to us a little bit more about which tools are actually available to the state? Because it's a pretty interesting framework to think about colonization. Often we think about it as a political or historical kind of process, but thinking about it as a tool or a strategy, how does colonization sit amongst other political strategies?
Yeah, and that's kind of the motivating puzzle, I guess, of the book. And to make it concrete, it would be a kind of question like, why did Britain end up making land available for European settlers in Australia, but not in India, for instance, over the same time period? Or for Indonesia, it would be, well, Indonesia has controlled West Papua since the early 1960s, but as I show in the book, Indonesia only started settling West Papua with large numbers of people from islands like Java or Bali in the mid to late 1980s. So colonization is one strategy amongst many others that states can use to exert control over peripheries. So I distinguish between assimilation. So states, when they annex new territory, like say Russia is doing in Ukraine right now, they can try to maintain control over that area, that new area, by turning the pre-existing people into members of the pre-existing nation, to turn them into Russians, to ban the Ukrainian language, for instance. And that's what Indonesia did initially in West Papua too, where they tried to kind of change cultural mores among indigenous Papuans and to turn them into kind of members of the Indonesian nation. And so that's one way that states can kind of maintain control over a frontier area. That was also the case initially in British officials like Lachlan Macquarie in New South Wales, who initially tried to assimilate the Indigenous Australian population and turn them into agriculturalists. So states often try to assimilate, but they can also use more coercive strategies to maintain control over frontier areas. And these vary. They can include ethnic cleansing, so you can push unwanted population, whether, say, the ethnic Ukrainians in eastern Ukraine, you can push them over to Ukraine, the rest of Ukraine, or for West Papuans, you can try and push them over into Papua New Guinea. So that's like kind of pushing out is one strategy states can use. Or they can try and move a new population in. That's what I talk about a lot in the book, and it's the main focus, colonization, when states bring in a new population who basically displace that pre-existing population, and that's often a very effective way for states to permanently secure control over a new frontier. And finally, if they can't bring in a new population and they can't easily displace a pre-existing population, then states can also turn to military occupation and incarceration and ultimately genocide. And so we see states, whether it's China in Xinjiang, Indonesia in West Papua, Israel in Palestine, Britain in Australasia, you see them switching between all of these strategies at different points in time, moving people in, pushing people out, killing people, occupying people, but also trying to assimilate people. And so the book is trying to understand, you know, when states select this particular strategy of moving people in and pushing people out over these both more coercive and less coercive alternatives.
In the book, you challenge the assumption that decolonization, this is a quote, is a process that only applies to European empires. Can you explain why it's important to challenge that assumption?
You know, it's funny, when I wrote the book, this may seem kind of academic, but I think people are talking about the lens of decolonization to understand Russia increasingly because of kind of Russia's new imperial project in the Baltics or in Ukraine. There has been a strange inconsistency, I guess you could say, in how both academics and the public talk about the end of empire and decolonization as a process that basically applied only to five countries, maybe Britain, France, Portugal, the Netherlands, and maybe Spain. But that's about it, where we talk about how these states had once controlled large populations who wanted their own independent nation ultimately, and we talk about decolonization as the kind of the means by which these colonized peoples around the world secured some measure of self-determination. But it's really not clear why that same terminology and framework isn't also applicable to, say, Russia and Russia's relationship with Balkan peoples or Ukrainians or people in Central Asia, or China's relationship to Tibetans and Uyghurs, or Indonesia's relationship with West Papuans or Acheans, or a whole host of other minority groups like the Kurds in Middle East. And these are all groups who seek their own independent nation state but are being kind of actively repressed by their host governments. And the terminology of decolonization, of indigenous self-determination, is surely just as applicable to the struggles of these groups as the struggles of earlier nations against European empires. But we don't usually think about or try to understand decolonization as an unfinished process because it's politically uncomfortable, or maybe it's hard to kind of think what are the similar dynamics between the end of European empire and the collapse of the Soviet Union or the end of the Chinese empire. In the book, I'm trying to place all of these things together, these dynamics together, and think about what dynamics lead to the end of empire generally, not just European empires, but also kind of non-Western empires.
So why do states sometimes choose to utilize colonization rather than those other options that you've mentioned, like ethnic cleansing or pushing people out of the state or genocide? Why do they resort to colonization? In the book, you mentioned that colonization is often actually really uneconomical and isn't necessarily the first strategy that states reach for. So why do they reach for it when they do?
So I talk about two main conditions under which states elect to settle people in a frontier. And the first are kind of logics of what I call settler-led colonization programs. And actually, Melbourne is a really good example of this. So settler-led colonization happens when settlers of their own volition, often when they face kind of population pressure at home and have better weaponry than indigenous peoples in the frontier, may begin to push into a frontier of their own volition. And the state, under these circumstances, is often in a crisis because it does not want to inflame conflict with indigenous peoples on the frontier. And this is why it's often so costly, because if they allow settlers from their home cities to move into a frontier, then there's going to be war in the short term, and they're going to have to send soldiers, and conflict is just very economically costly to states. So they're trying to avoid conflict with peoples in the frontier, but settlers may just move into frontier areas anyway. And I discuss in the book how this really describes the dynamic of what happened in North America, where both the British state after the Seven Years' War, but also the American state after the American Revolution, tried to limit American settlers moving across the Appalachians, but basically because they didn't want to inflame conflict with the indigenous nations there, who had been their previous allies. But these settlers kept encroaching into areas that were kind of forbidden, and this led to all-out war between the state and indigenous peoples in the short term. And again, this was the kind of dynamic that described Melbourne very well. So in the 1830s, Victoria, or what is now Victoria, was essentially off-limits to British settlement, but a number of individual settlers decided that they were going to basically colonize Port Phillip Bay. They created a private company and landed here under Batman. And that's the origin story of our city. It was a kind of settler-led colonization project. And at the time, the British officials in New South Wales and London declared that this settlement was essentially null and void and to be disbanded because it's on Crown land that was not to be taken by private settlers. But these settlers named their city Melbourne because they were trying to appeal to the then British Prime Minister and say, well, you know, we've named our city after you. You shouldn't displace us. We're you. And so the British officials at the time had to weigh up. Do we send soldiers over there and try and displace these settlers? Again, costly thing. Or do we just let settlers take any quote-unquote wasteland, land that isn't being currently utilized, and basically that this may lead to kind of short-term conflict, but we're going to turn a blind eye to all the atrocities in the frontier. And that's basically what they did. They thought there was the least costly and least conflictual thing was just to just turn a blind eye and let European settlers move into wasteland, even though they knew that much of this land wasn't actually wasteland. And that's the story of homesteading in North America, as well as the story of the colonization of Zimbabwe in the late 1800s under Cecil John Rhodes. Again, an area Britain tried to prevent settlers moving into, but they moved into it anyway, and the state just turned a blind eye. So that's kind of logic of settler-led colonization. When you have population pressure in the core, settlers who have better weaponry, often you see states kind of having these incoherent policies trying to limit settlement, but then authorizing it, but then not really opening up land themselves, but leaving it to the settlers to kind of engage in kind of ethnic cleansing or genocide. But then state-led colonization is quite different. So in settings like West Papua or Xinjiang or French settlement in New Caledonia, it's none of these things were really settler-led. In all of these cases, the state is actively displacing indigenous peoples, taking their land, reallocating their lands to settlers. And so the state is kind of embedded in these projects much more so than settler-led colonization or homesteading. And the reasons why states often try and displace indigenous peoples, relocate their lands to settlers, is usually it's a counterinsurgency strategy. It's a strategy to win a war. So when there's a war going on, whether it's the ongoing insurgency in West Papua that the Indonesian state has had to face since the 1960s, or there's a threat of invasion from a foreign party like China faced against the USSR in the 1960s, states really want to create basically a first line of defense in the frontier. And so we'll turn to basically soldier farmers to garrison the frontier. And so that's basically the reason why Indonesia in the 1980s began to settle West Papua en masse, is that there was an insurgency on the borderland with Papua New Guinea, and it wanted to garrison the borderland with non-Papuans who were clearly not indigenous insurgents, who clearly not guerrillas, and who they could use to basically police the frontier. And so that's why to the current day, the areas of West Papua that are kind of the most Muslim predominated or most settler predominated are the areas right on the border with Papua New Guinea, because so many settlers were sent there by the Indonesian state as a tool of border control. So state-led colonization we see around the world today in settings like Kashmir or the West Bank or Xinjiang or the Middle East generally, because these are the areas that have so much intense interstate conflict over territory, and states find it really quick and easy to just settle those contested areas with members of their own dominant ethnic group who are going to be loyal, who are going to garrison the frontier. And that's a tool for basically state building in contested region.
So where to from here? It's such a crucial tactic for states to either respond to the movements of settlers or to expand their state frontiers and borders, or even just to ensure the security of their state. Will we have colonization as long as we have states? Do they go together?
That's a depressing note to kind of strike, but I think, yes, like because colonization, Machiavelli, this book is really a response to Machiavelli, who provided the model of kind of state building to a devious leader in the 1300s. He suggests that, yes, of course, a diligent ruler will always, in an area that's contested, with populated by an ethnic group that isn't part of the core of your group, you've got to displace them and settle those lands with members of your own group. So Machiavelli's manual to state leaders suggests, yeah, that it's always going to be a really expedient tool for states to use to settle contested frontiers in the midst of war. And I think that's, you know, why we see so much population movement, displacement to the current day in these settings of, you know, intense territorial and secessionist conflict. So states are a real problem, and it's unclear, you know, whether they will ever go away. But if they do not ever go away, there's still hope. And the hope that I strike in the book is that one other dynamic changes the relationship between states and settlers. So states, both state-led and settler-led colonization, really rely on settlers being willing to move to the frontier, being willing to settle that frontier, garrison that frontier, stay in that frontier. And that's been true for most of human history. Humans, where land is the most valuable asset, have been really willing to move hundreds of thousands of miles to get free land. But increasingly, that is not the case. Over the course of the 20th century, we've moved from a predominantly rural society to a predominantly urban one in much of the world, and particularly in places like Australia. As people get wealthier, they actually don't want to become farmers and stay on the farm. They want to move to urban centres where there are good jobs, good services, a good social life, good educational opportunities. So the core message of the book really is that as states get richer, they increasingly find it challenging to colonize frontier regions. And I examine this through the lens of a number of countries, but particularly Australia, which has kind of long been seen as a kind of canonical settler state. But I point out that ironically, Australia was a really ineffective settler state over the much of the 20th century in its major colony of Papua New Guinea, which was initially envisioned as the kind of seventh Australian state. And there was a major project in the early 20th century to settle white farmers there. And the Australian government opened up large amounts of free land to any white male settler who'd be willing to move to Papua over the early 20th century. But very few people did. And the few people who did move quickly left because the millions of Europeans who emigrated to Australia over the 20th century wanted to move to Melbourne and Sydney. They didn't want to move to Papua. And so the government basically had to subsidize Europeans moving to the frontier. They couldn't just give them free land. They have to build schools, build hospitals, build good housing. And one report from the 1950s that was kind of weighing up whether Australia should do this, because after World War II, Japan had just invaded Papua New Guinea, and Australia wanted to settle large numbers of whites in Papua New Guinea to provide a first line of defense against a future invasion from the north. So this report commissioned by the government basically estimated that the government would have to spend $1 million per settler to get people to move to Papua New Guinea, which is a lot of money. So to get 300,000 people to move to Papua New Guinea would cost the Australian government about $300 billion, which is basically like a non-starter. And we can't even get a train to the airport. You know, we're not going to get a $300 billion to spend on colonizing Papua New Guinea, especially because there was so much pressure to spend that money elsewhere in Australia. So Australia ultimately abandoned its settler colonial project in Papua New Guinea precisely because it became so expensive to entice people to that area, and much more expensive than it was in the 1800s when people were willing to move from Ireland, from England, or elsewhere just for free land and for gold. And that's quite different to a country like Indonesia on the other side of the border in West Papua, which has been so effective at getting large, like 300,000 people to move to West Papua just by offering free land, because land is still such a valuable asset in Indonesia. So there's an irony here, basically, that rich states like Australia are really ineffective settler colonizers, whereas poor states like Australia in the 1800s or Indonesia today are really effective colonizers. So as states get richer, ultimately indigenous peoples are much harder to displace, which gives them much more power vis-a-vis central governments and much more ability to kind of demand independence and achieve it, as Papua New Guineans ultimately did in the 1970s.
One of your really interesting contentions in the book is that colonization isn't actually primarily ideological. So a lot of people make an association between colonization and racial ideologies and hierarchies, or for instance, view it as a vehicle for global elites to amass more wealth and power. You basically suggest that that is not the case, and it's actually primarily about pragmatic decision-making of the state motivated by essentially economic and political expediency. So can you explain to us where ideology does fit into this picture? What role does the ideological context play in states colonizing?
Where ideology fits is, I think ideologies are very important in shaping the areas that states feel like are their homeland, where they want to exert control over, and as well as who the kind of core loyal group of that nation is and who the outgroups are. And that kind of shapes, I guess, this, a state's desired territorial extent. So it's no coincidence, for instance, that Russia seeks to control the predominantly Russian-speaking areas of Eurasia, or China wants to maintain control over areas that were formerly part of the Qing Empire. Like, these are kind of foundational ideologies of the state. The point I'm trying to make in the book is that these ideologies leave open a number of things. States can exert control over territory, as we talked before, through a number of different means. Colonization is just one amongst many strategies that states can use to maintain control over a frontier area. And so we have to think about, when we think about Indonesia and West Papua, China and Xinjiang, the history there is really of the Chinese and Indonesian state switching from assimilation to displacement to colonization and to, in Xinjiang's case, mass incarceration. It's colonization is just one of many forms of coercion, and so we have to get more analytical about thinking when states substitute between one and the other, when colonization is more effective or easily able to be executed than these other strategies. Because this leads to my second point, which is that colonization is essentially a story about migration. This is a process of migration in which people elect to move to a frontier area and displace a pre-existing population. And this really relies on settlers being willing to emigrate. Instances of settler-led colonization, like I talked about before, like in Melbourne or across the Appalachians in Western United States, all of these cases were really of ideology was following the settlers, right? The settlers were the ones doing the colonizing, and then they, after they had displaced the pre-existing population, they then created these ideologies of terra nullius to retrospectively justify what they had just done. But these ideologies were followed. They were kind of justifications. They weren't the actual cause of these colonization programs, which were driven by settler interests in amassing land. And that's the same for state-led colonization programs as well. Even in settings where a state wants to maintain control over a certain area, like I talked about with Australia and Papua New Guinea, where Australia saw Papua as a potential seventh state, wanted to turn it white, it ultimately wasn't able to do so because it wasn't able to get migrants to move there, to get whites to move there. And in the end, what changed was not the migration, but the ideology. In the 1970s, Australia then just decolonized Papua New Guinea, and now we think Papua New Guinea, part of Australia, crazy. But, you know, a century ago, there was in all our maps, and we had Barton and Deakin and other prime ministers who really saw Papua New Guinea is the vanguard of an Australasian empire. But our ideologies changed as this colonization program failed. So ideologies kind of operate in the background, I think, as justifications for colonization programs, as well as shaping where states want to exert control over. But colonization is a story about migration, and we really have to think about the individual economic interests of migrants and how they've changed and how that in turn changed the ideologies of states like Australia.
So what you're offering us with your book is basically a framework for understanding colonization across time, across cultures. So with that in mind, how does that help us understand what's taking place in Gaza right now?
So I spend a bit of time in the book talking about Israel, because Israel is, you know, I collected a lot of data on this, on colonization projects around the world. It's a real outlier empirically. Most states who are currently engaged in a kind of project of displacing an indigenous population and settling their lands are poor states, the states of GDP per capita less than 5,000. But Israel really stands out as like kind of the only Western or highly developed state that has a settler colonial project today. And in some ways, this might be seen as a contradiction of the argument of the book, right? Because the book's argument is that only really poor states can colonize frontier areas, because only they can get individuals to move to frontier areas, whereas rich states, it's really hard to do so. So basically, my response to this in the book is I delve into Israel's failed colonization project in Gaza, which is a really interesting counterpoint to, you know, its successful settlements in the West Bank. So after Israel annexed Gaza in the late 1960s, it created a settlement project there called Gush Katif, much like its settlement projects in the West Bank today. But unlike its settlement projects in the West Bank, it really struggled to get large numbers of Jewish settlers to move to southern Gaza. And this was largely because of Gaza's relative distance to major metropolitan areas relative to the West Bank. Because when we're talking about the West Bank, we're really talking about a very small area. It's almost as if Melbourne was trying to colonize the Mornington Peninsula. Like, it's really not a difficult ask to get people to move to settlements in the Mornington Peninsula and then commute to metropolitan Melbourne. For an urbanite, if they're given a subsidized mortgage, you can imagine that being something that the Victorian government could really easily execute. Whereas the colonization of Gaza was more like trying to get people to move to, I'm really stretching this analogy here, to Warrnambool. It's just that bit further and almost impossible to commute back and forth to metropolitan Melbourne. So that meant that it was really an appealing option, especially because by the 1990s, Jewish settlers in Gaza were under almost like daily attack from rockets. So very few people were willing to move to A, such a geographically distant, and B, such a dangerous location. And this created a crisis for Israeli leaders like Ariel Sharon in the early 2000s, who was formerly one of the biggest proponents of settling Gaza and keeping Gaza in the Israeli fold. But he did a dramatic switch in 2005 where he pulled out all the settlements and disengaged Israel from Gaza, aka turned over Gaza to a Palestinian authority. And so basically the story of Gaza there is that Israel didn't know what to do with the, say, 2 million Gazans and the 10,000 or so Jewish settlers there. They didn't want to give citizenship to the Palestinians there because that would destabilize Israel's demographic equilibrium and mean that the Jewish proportion of the population would drop to what they saw as a dangerous level. But they also couldn't settle the area with Jewish people. So they decided to do what Australia and Papua New Guinea did, which is just cleave off that area from the state. Australia didn't want to give citizenship to Papua New Guineans either, but couldn't get whites to move there, so it granted independence to Papua New Guinea. Israel didn't want to give citizenship to Palestinians, voting rights in particular, but couldn't get Jewish people to move there, so it just cleaved off that area from the Israeli state. So what we see in Gaza is kind of a within-case comparison, I guess, of the West Bank and Gaza, I think helps illustrate the book's argument quite nicely, which is that rich states really struggle to settle frontier areas like Gaza or Papua New Guinea, which means that they are much more likely to grant independence to those areas in the long run. But areas that are really close to urban areas like the West Bank, Israel's not going to settle for less. It's not going to give up that territory so long as it's able to settle that area with Jewish settlers. That's still what it sees as its best case scenario. But this ultimately kind of, this answer looks very different after October 7th. Israel has now gone back into Gaza and is unsure what to do, essentially. It's trying to defeat Hamas, that's a stated objective, through a prolonged military occupation, it seems like. Its other options have been bandied about by Israeli leaders, as well as, you know, Jared Kushner was in the news yesterday for, you know, maybe it's best for Israel to move Palestinians temporarily into the Egyptian desert whilst it transforms Gaza, which would be a kind of ethnic cleansing, at least as it categorizes in the book, pushing people out. So it's a number of like extremists, I guess, Israeli politicians have bandied about ideas like this, like maybe it's just easy to get rid of Gazans by having them just settled around the world by taken in as refugees. But, you know, other states like Egypt have basically flat out refused to take in Gazans because they don't want Israel to be able to do this. So Israel's stuck. It's facing a prolonged insurgency in Gaza. It can't settle Jewish settlers there. It can't really displace the Palestinians to a neighboring state, which all that leaves is military occupation And that's essentially what I talk about in the book, as well as what we see in Xinjiang too. Xinjiang is also essentially under prolonged military occupation because China really doesn't see any other way to squash Uyghur independence or self-determination movements. The danger here for both China and Xinjiang and Israel and Gaza is that military occupations have a real tendency of failing to defeat self-determination movements. And Machiavelli actually was the one to warn of this in the 1300s. He said, you know, if you're a state leader and you want to maintain control over a new territory, the last thing you want to do is send in soldiers. They're going to cost you money and they're going to irritate the local population and they're going to basically lead to your downfall. What you want to do is send in settlers who are going to be a loyal force and are going to not cost you any money because they'll just reproduce themselves. So Israel and China are both in this stuck situation. Long-term military occupations that are going to cost a lot and ultimately backfire by fostering resentment both among Palestinians and Uyghurs, which is essentially going to create a pressure cooker situation and is not going to resolve anything in the medium term. So that would be my kind of prediction, I suppose. Both China and Israel have turned to military occupation because they cannot engage in settler colonialism anymore, and they don't want to give up these frontier territories, but it's not clear really how effective or how coherent that is as a strategy.
If people want to find out more about your theory of colonization, or they want to read the book, or they want to hear more from you, how would they do that?
Well, the book is available from Princeton University website, and if you use the code P321, you get 20% off, which is nice. It's really not a lot of money. It's like $30. It's also available from, like, you know, any major bookseller, so Amazon, Readings, or anywhere really. So yeah, and if you read the book, if you like it, if you don't like it, please just shoot me an email. I'd love to hear from you.